1998, and this is our interview with Corinne Sanchez. So do you want to start with some of the stuff that I was wondering last time? Was we didn't talk very much about your personal background, just your family background and stuff, and you just shared that picture of your mother with me. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how, if you can kind of paint a picture of how you came to consciousness around, you know, Chicano issues and Chicana issues, like women's issues within the Chicano movement. Mm-hmm. If we can talk about that. Because in a way, it's very interesting that some of the women hold very traditional views, but they're contesting certain traditions within the culture. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if we could talk about that.
Well, I don't think it really came to my consciousness until I actually experienced it myself. And I didn't either acknowledge it or realize it was happening until went to Long Beach State. And that was in the Chicano, the Mecha organization. So I think you do all the work, which, as we said earlier, cooking and flyer preparation and organization preparation. You do everything that you think everybody's doing together when really it's a few, of course, like in anything, but it's usually just women. And you start observing that and you start raising it as the issue. And then you find the conflict, you find the protests by the men and women that protested, that you go along with the mainstream and you go along with the whole, because as you said earlier, it becomes, they look at it as divisiveness. But I think it came to the forefront at Long Beach State when you paid all your dues, so to speak, and didn't expect to get the respect and the recognition of what you've done, and you don't. And quite frankly, it's blatant. It's like when you speak, no one would listen. When you would write something, no one would read it. When you raise the issue to discuss it in some fair manner, some principled manner, you're really discredited. And it becomes not only very excuse me, painful, but it becomes very objectionable, and either you go along with the majority or you fight it, and that's what we did. We fought it, and there were a few of us who spoke out against it and, as you know, organized around the issues that we felt really inhibited us, damaged the whole movement, because it's really the contrary view we took. We said, you know, it's not that we're dividing the movement, we're strengthening it. Because when you have two people or two sexes, two genders involved, you have a strong, and if you have a stronger family unit, you have a stronger movement. So we saw it in a very positive, concrete manner, where they saw it in a very divisive and depleting manner as to what the real issues were. And that's really how it came about, and continues to this day, as you know, I interpret my reality.
So, I'm interested in that because the rhetoric of the movement was very family and, you know, mm-hmm. culture based, mm-hmm. and in some ways I think that was used to silence women, like this is a place in our culture, this is our place, you know, but most of the women I'm talking to, that's not their experience until they got there. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that their moms told them that or their families told them that or... Mm-hmm. Or maybe they had been told that, but they hadn't. It wasn't necessarily their reality, and it wasn't that they came to have a consciousness around women until the movement. Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting. I mean, so do you think that you were raised traditionally? And
oh, absolutely. I was raised in a very traditional family in the sense that there was a mother and father, and the father was a dominant figure, and you always obeyed that figure. Mm-hmm. Now, the reality is you, again, see things differently. You're told by your mother your father's in charge, mm-hmm. and your father's the head of the home, yet my mother worked, you know, as well throughout our growing up. But it was actually like you were told, you know, your father's in charge, but really I knew my mother was in charge. Mm-hmm. We were told my dad made all the decisions, but yet we knew my mother made the decisions. we were told we were going to be punished by our father, but yet my mother is the one who actually punished us. And in our days, it was physical. There was no lectures.
No
time out. I mean, you know, physically, I was hit quite a bit as a child. You know, today, my mother would have been arrested, quite frankly. I mean, belts, clothes hangers, probably, I won't say severe, but very harsh hittings. And I think very young, I challenged a lot of things because I paid attention to what I saw versus what I heard. And luckily, you know, I would voice my opposition and I got hit more probably because of that. I think your childhood is very, very important in terms of who we are, and it was rooted that, you know, you do what you're told to do and not ask about why you do it. And I went to college, to junior college before I went to Long Beach State. And they were very opposed to why I was going to college, because I was only going to get married anyway and have children, and there was no need. And so that was my first probably big step in going to college there at home. I didn't leave San Bernardino, I went to the junior college. But I always believed if you worked hard, that was something ingrained very young. You work hard, you will achieve whatever it is you set out to achieve. And when I went on, well, there was one intermediate point. I actually bought into the Anglo concept of the sorority, fraternity status at San Bernardino, and I became one of the first Chicanas, if probably one of the few, who was in a sorority. And I went through all the crap they put you through. I mean, it's just incredible. But again, I said, I have to pay my dues. I've always been this type of person. I have to work hard, pay my dues, and then feel that I was a whole person. And that's another thing, just going back a little bit, coming from a large family of eight, the value you have as a child, it's really hard to be given to you with so many children. But I always was looking for a place, a value, a recognition. And coming from a big family, you know, you really don't get it. Or in a poor big family, right, because parents are always working. So when I went to junior college, I thought, oh, now I'll be in a sorority and I'll be white and I'll be right and I'll be, you know, valuable.
What you should do, what you're trying to do.
And I went through everything, and then I found that it was a big fraud as far as I was concerned, because the sorority was really to, I thought it was for the social being and the well-being of women, and it was really, yeah. And so I says, I really don't want any part of this. And after I went through Hell Week and got the sanctioning or whatever it was to be a sorority sister, I left the sorority. And through, you know, consultation with the dean of women, I really said, this is really a fraud. I mean, they're not helping other women. It's about, you know, getting men and being part of a party scene and not doing the kind of things I think that are beneficial to our society. But I left it and relinquished being part of any institutionalized group at that time. And again, my family was really opposed to me leaving San Bernardino, and I went to Long Beach State. And again, I was really deliberate thinking I was going to become a physical ed teacher and a history teacher in Long Beach State, as you know, is really one of the best colleges for that. So when I went to Long Beach State, again, I felt, you know, work hard and pay my dues. And really, the physical ed department was a big feminist department. I mean, you know, there's the stereotypes that many of the women are lesbian or never get married, or they're really anti-men. And that's where really my roots also were developed. I saw the women, you had women head of departments, chairs of departments, very pro-woman. And they were very nurturing of me at Long Beach State. But I had identified more with the Latino struggle than I did with the women's struggle at the time. Mm-hmm. That's when I got involved in MECHA. Mm-hmm. And the women there really were very very supportive of me, and they wanted me to continue to get my master's and become actually a chair there of the department. I mean, that's how much advanced really the women's division or departments or women-focused centers are of women as opposed to your, you know, generic or mixed American studies departments. But I was developing, and I didn't see that. I really didn't see that. So I did get my degree there in physical ed and history, but I really got involved with the Chicano movement and then became very involved with the women's movement, with the Chicano movement mm-hmm. from that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. So do you think it was how did you get involved with UMass and Mecha? Do you remember how that process happened for you? Was it just natural? Or
mm-hmm. It was very natural. It was, first of all, it was new mm-hmm. for me. And it was happening at Long Beach State. I was actually there. I went right from my mid-session, February in San Bernardino Valley, to the summer session, I forgot what they call the sessions, but after the February, I went right to Long Beach State. And I stayed the summer, and that's where EOP was being developed and Upward Bound, and this UMAS group, United Mexican American Students, was being developed. I don't really remember personally how I got attracted to it, but I remember them being students getting together to talk about the struggle and the need to unite, and I did identify with that right away as a Latina. As a Mexican American, rather than as a woman, so much.
Right.
It just was more like how come there's only so few people that go on to college? And I identify with my inability to get to college. And again, it goes back to, why should I go to college? Because I'm a woman and I'm going to have children. But I was saying, guy, there isn't that many of us going to college. And here I am at this massive university at the time. There was 30,000 population. Yeah, it was really big for the state of California. It was one of the largest. And there were so few of us. And it seemed to me, because I was a C student, that it was even fewer of us because many of us weren't college bound. So I really identified with bridging that.
Right. Do you think it was because you saw that from where you came from, but also because you experienced certain conditions once you got to Cal State Long Beach? Because it's different than living in your own community, being close to your home and community. When you go to Long Beach, and it's huge, and it was mostly white. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you mm-hmm. experience overt forms of discrimination that made you say, I have to be involved, or
no.
It was just a more...
Not at all. Matter of fact, I was sharing with you in terms of the department, they were all Anglo women. Mm-hmm. Very, very supportive of me, and the professors were very, very supportive of me. Matter of fact, the only reason I'm where I am is because of professors who were Anglo supported me. First of all, there's very few Latinos or Latinas.
Right.
And it was those people that had some knowledgeable, and they were compassionate toward just students in general, and then I think they had the sophistication or the awareness that there wasn't that many of us. So I did not experience any blatant racism on campus by anyone until, of course, I became aware that the racism that existed was institutionalized, and it was very subtle, it was very covert, it was very, I started analyzing it on a factual basis, like what you're doing is researching and, looking at the students that graduated, and I left high school. First of all, I graduated from high school,
right.
And I realized I had been tracked, which I didn't realize
right.
at the time. So I started looking at the subtleties that I had been exposed to, and then I looked at how massive it was, because I became very involved with the Pintos movement.
Mm-hmm.
I went to prisons. I had a brother who was incarcerated. So I became very involved with the Pinto, as we call them, the Tecatos movement. I started visiting the prisons, the youth authorities, and I started seeing they were all Latinos and blacks. And so it was really through Long Beach State and my research, similar to yours, and questioning things, that I realized the racism was very institutionalized and very subtle, you know, while we're in prisons, are we more criminally oriented? No, we're more, we're arrested more and convicted more because the system is imposing those kinds of things on us, and they continue today. So I just started really realizing through research and knowledge how system-wide it was in our society that needed to be attacked. And that's how I became even more and more involved.
So what kind of work did you do in the prisons?
We went there and we did, you know, lectures on, you know, Chicano culture and, you know, improving, getting them, recruiting them. Our whole emphasis was recruitment to colleges.
Right.
So we had a whole group of Bintos that went from the prisons. We'd recruit them and they would come to the campus. So we would do lectures, recruitment. We'd go there and do tutorial assistance, just positive reinforcement of, it was both men and women we would deal with.
It's amazing.
Yeah. We went to Terminal Island. We went to a lot. I don't remember all of them. Went to quite a lot of them.
Right.
And we were allowed in, which is interesting.
It is. Well, I wanted to go back to and ask you some stuff. Yeah. I wanted to go back and kind of get those pivotal moments about coming to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think everyone's trajectory into that is a little bit different. And that's kind of what makes up history, right? How people decide to do those things. And so I just, if there's anything else that you wanted to talk to me about as far as how, you know, how you came to that, how you came to that. Because it's not automatic that people just went to Long Beach State and then they got involved in politics. And then they got involved in women's politics within the Chicano movement. So, you know, I wanted to ask that.
Excuse me. I don't know, Maylee, what other... I mean, there's probably so many, but I think, you know, because we were all involved with the Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War, the Huelga strike, the Católicos por la Raza strike, in terms of the church. We were taking on all the institutions of racism.
Right.
And it was all those things, particularly Anna and I, we were walking the picket lines, we were, you know, demonstrating and all these causes, and we kept seeing ourselves relegated to keeping quiet and being pushed aside. And more so at Long Beach State because that's where the threat was, because we went to school there, and the men in the other campuses were more open to us and more embracing of us because we weren't on their campus. We weren't on UCLA's campus. We were on Berkeley's campus. We were at Long Beach State. And I think when I worked with the paper, I shared with you La Raza paper in East LA. And I shared with you Risco had, and another woman, Ruth Robinson, had really gotten us involved with writing, and that's where Alacran and our paper came out, that we could excel outside of the male-dominated Chicano movement. So our voice started being, we started making our voice heard as women in all the realms of the various causes. And I think, you know, getting the various diseases, like venereal diseases, most of us came in contact with, how to go to the health departments. We start learning more about our physical being and our physical well-being, safety, our lives. That also made a point that, you know, no one else is going to take care of that but ourselves.
Right.
So the soul health, the self-health movement became very important to us as well. Our bodies, ourselves, was a real important document to us in terms of, you know, not being ashamed of talking about our parts of the bodies and touching parts of our bodies which were really forbidden in our upbringing. So the more and more we ventured out from the main movement stream and looked at ourselves as women and caring for ourselves as women, I think those were very important, I know, to me, that I continue in that vein.
Right.
Because it's about our survival.
Right. I think it's interesting that, because that's the same, a similar story that Anna told, is that it was through the community activism
mm-hmm.
that she felt validated as an activist, and she felt like she saw the bigger picture of the Chicano struggle. Because the way the history is written, it's very segregated. Like, there's a student movement, and then there's a Chicano movement, and within it there's issues, the moratorium, the blowouts, the, you know? Mm-hmm. But it seems like you all cross those boundaries, and I don't know if that's the way the history is written or the way it happened historically. I can't figure that out. But it seemed like you all did a lot of community work. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just campus politics.
Not at all. Matter of fact, mainly I observe that today. That's my observation, is the students are limited to the participation on the campus. We were in the communities. We were on the campus. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were on the campus as students and as organizers. But our work, all our work was, you figure we were at supermarkets, Safeway, picketing. We were at the church in St. Basilica's or St. Basil's in Wilshire Boulevard protesting. We fasted for 3 days. We were, I mean, all our activity was outside the campus. It wasn't till later we would come in and demand more students, demand more programs for us as students, demand that women be represented in our organizations as students on the campus, that we started the rioting on the campuses to say this is where it has to change as well, mm-hmm. to then affect or impact what we do daily out in the community.
Right.
So more our protest was what we brought from the community to the campus, right. that it be acknowledged and somehow make a change there so later it would come back to the community.
Right.
But did our protests weren't on campus. I mean, that was not where our activity or our protest was centered.
Right. Do you remember what else you all were involved in? Were you involved with the Long Beach community at all, specifically, or?
We were involved with, that's a very interesting point. That developed later. We did get involved with the community, but it was with, like, leaders that already existed in the community, like Ann Ramirez, who worked for Congressman Anderson in San Pedro. It was like, Josie was a teacher for the school district, and she was in Wilmington, and so we were involved with the Wilmington community there, and then Long Beach, there was key people in Long Beach that we were organizing there with needs, but quite frankly, that developed after. It was like we were more involved with the global issues as a community nationwide and worldwide, mm-hmm. than local.
Right.
It's almost like Long Beach State community or Long Beach community and then Long Beach State community were really ancillary or a small part. I mean, we really looked at, you know, here you got farm workers,
right.
throughout the state and the nation that are not getting equal pay and that, all that. Right. Was it the church as a system is oppressive toward women and Latinos and controlling? And we looked at that, you know, which is just really universal. Mm-hmm. So really, quite frankly, no, our activities really generated from global kinds of issues.
Right.
And so our energies were more global. Then, you know, like now my energies are very community and very mm-hmm. Geographic specific.
Right. Well, can you tell me about how you got involved with La Raza newspaper? Do you remember the details? Did you write? Did you work?
I wrote and I worked, yes. Anna and I both did. It had to be through some of the movements off campus and Risco being so open to us learning how to do paper, mm-hmm. newspaper, that we took advantage of every opportunity that was offered to us and just became involved with writing.
What, do you remember what years?
It had to be in the 60s, late 60s.
And that you would go to protests and then you would write about them?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Were you assigned to specific things or you just documented where you were at?
No, we did whatever we wanted to. That was the other thing we liked, you know? We could write whatever we wanted to.
Right. And did you have bylines on the papers? Because a lot of people in that newspaper, they weren't specifically like that person wrote that piece. So I don't remember.
Probably not. I don't remember.
Geta Miranda, she was at Cal State LA. she's my neighbor right now, but
she's your neighbor?
Yeah, she's in grad school. She's with me.
I don't remember her.
She's at Cal State LA. She was at Cal State LA, and I think she had met up with the Long Beach group at the regional conference that was pre-Houston.
Yeah, that's the other thing,
and
we did a lot.
And then she went to Houston with you guys.
Yeah, we went a lot to conferences.
So I had just talked to her about this, but she wrote for Barasa newspaper too. But
I wonder if I saw her picture, I might remember her.
Okay.
But yeah, that's the other thing you talk about. We were very involved with all the conferences. Any Latino, you know, it wasn't Latino, it was Chicano conference. We were there. Whether it was in Denver, it was in Arizona, it was in Texas. I mean, that was our thing.
Right.
And that even made us more broad in our perspective, because then we realized we identified with our brothers and sisters in other states that face the same, very same issues.
Did you remember any kind of regionalism, though?
Regionalism.
Like regional issues? Like, I've come across that some Tejano activists with Brazo Unida, they were very specific about the kind of politics they did versus California politics, which tend to be a little bit more nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've run across that just in interviews. And mm-hmm. Do you remember that there was any kind of regional rivalry or notions that things were different out here? Or?
Well, there was definitely a perception we were white from other movements.
Wow.
Because they saw us more assimilated. With many of us had lost our Spanish ability to speak Spanish.
Mm.
Our strong identity. I actually think we were less nationalistic than some of the other states. Because I saw it as broader. I saw it very institutionalized. The enemy was much bigger than one individual, or I just saw it across the board. And I tended to agree with them that yes, we didn't speak Spanish anymore. Many of us were not really that strongly rooted in the Mexican traditional customs because we had somewhat assimilated.
But it also has to do with generation, you know.
Yeah, but we did.
Not first generation or second generation anymore.
But the Texans, let me tell you, they were very adamant about us. They were really, I think Texans were our biggest challenge and enemies for a while as Latinos. But, I mean, we still would connect on the broader issues, on the more substantive issues, I thought substantive issues,
mm-hmm.
as being, you know, people that were oppressed. And the bigger issue was the man, the system.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, so much how much more Mexican you were than I or Latino
right.
than I.
Right.
That was always a big conflict. So Latinos in California were always looked as Anglos more so. And they realized that we were, because we weren't so, I thought, identified to the Mexican culture. I just thought we were better able to attack the real problem. The real problem, as I saw, is a bigger system.
Do you remember what conferences you went to and what had happened, any of them? You just remember you went to them. Because I think we had talked about that you were at Denver.
With Corky Gonzalez. No, I do remember when they had women caucuses, well, Chicana caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, and talk about pivotal points, probably that was big awakenings, to not only hear other women, Latina women, Chicana women, talk about the struggle, it was exactly mine. And it just brought me closer to women's issues. When you met these women, I mean, I was just in awe, particularly of women who had already reached a point of consciousness and were doing something about it.
Right. Do you remember who they were?
If I really thought about it, you know, like Francisca Flores definitely was one of them, and I saw her at the Arizona conference, which was a Chicana conference, was a Latina conference.
Oh, what was
for
that?
Women in labor force or whatever, huh? Phoenix.
Remember? Phoenix, Arizona. Do you remember when it was? Was it before the Houston conference?
Oh yeah. Matter of fact, again, Meili, I actually have pictures from that conference and stuff of us being there, women being there. She's dead now, but she was an attorney and she's worked for the Justice Department. I can't remember her name. But she was from Arizona and she was very well respected. I was really impressed with her. So there were actually a lot of women of stature and they were doing things, women things.
Older women.
Yeah. They were my age then, you know. There's a woman in San Diego. She's still very active. She was an older woman. But she, you know, was very vocal, very radical, and she's still around. But people like that, you know, you just listened, and Dolores, of course, Huerta, Dorinda Moreno, you know, which later we split roads with, but, you know, she was somebody we really...
When did you meet her?
Respected. I don't know when I met